Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph.
I'm Artemis Irvin, and in today's episode, we're travelling back further in time than we've ever gone before on this podcast. To be precise, around 126,000 years ago, to meet our long extinct kindred, the Neanderthals. For many of us, casting the mind back as far as even the early medieval period can sometimes prove a conceptual challenge. When reading about ancient civilizations, the Greeks, Romans, and Egyptians sometimes seem more like distant historical subjects than actual human beings. And yet, in comparison to the historical period that we'll be looking at today, these subjects are practically modern. Between about 400,000 to 40,000 years ago, Neanderthals walked the earth. They hunted and crafted tools with skill, they loved and buried their fellow man, and they even made art. Introducing us to these enigmatic figures is the archaeologist and writer Dr. Rebecca Ragg-Sykes. Rebecca studied archaeology through to PhD level before completing a prestigious Marie Curie postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Bordeaux. Her first book, Kindred, Neanderthal, Life, Love, Death and Art, brings together 21st century scientific understanding of Neanderthals to challenge the stereotype that these were knuckle-dragging inferior predecessors to the enlightened Homo sapiens. Since its publication last month, Kindred has already been selected as one of the best books of 2020 by the Sunday Times, and Professor Brian Cox has described it as beautiful, evocative, and authoritative. So you can imagine it was such a pleasure that last week Rebecca took me on a travel into very deep time indeed. Thank you so much for joining us on Travels Through Time, Rebecca, and congratulations on publishing your book. That must be really exciting. I have to say, I found it not only an incredibly informative book, I mean, it's literally just full, every single page is full of so much information that I'm sure most people would have absolutely no idea about. But I also have to admit that I found it very moving. Oh. And a couple of times it brought me literally to tears.
Oh, that's so pleased. That's what I was trying to infuse the information that you know, like as a specialist, we know that there's just vast amounts of really cool stuff that does never, you know, never gets beyond the scientific journals into, even though Neanderthals grab the headlines, a lot of really fascinating stuff just doesn't really get out to the public. And I wanted to give people, you know, a real deep experience of that, but also connect people, you know, to that human past that Neanderthals clearly represent for so many people. So I'm so glad that you've had that reaction. That's exactly what I was hoping.
Yeah, exactly. I think there is something very emotive about being brought face to face in the way that you do in such detail and with the humanity of these people who are no longer with us, you know, a totally extinct people, but they're just, they really come alive on the page. There's obviously never not a good time to reflect on our humanity, because it makes you think about Homo sapiens humanity as well, obviously. But I was wondering if there was a moment which first sparked your inspiration for writing the book and you thought, yes, now is a good time to write this.
Oh gosh. Honestly, I kind of feel like this book has been waiting for me to write it for a long time. I was always really interested in the past, like even as a child, my family went on holidays and we would go to all the National Trust places around. And, you know, I was always imagining myself in the past in those places. But then when some of the holidays we went to on the continent, to France and some of the caves and the museums, and those places really blew me away. And, you know, I can remember watching sort of in the museums like a video of somebody napping, like making stone tools, and I, you know, virtually had to be dragged away back into the car park to go because I was so fascinated by it. And so this interest been there for a long time.
And like you say, each chapter looks at a different theme, and it kind of, each chapter adds another layer to your understanding of who they were and what their lives looked like. And I was wondering if you had a particularly favorite area of interest, a chapter that you enjoyed writing the most.
Oh, that's really tricky. I know which ones were hard. I mean, my training through my master's and my PhD was in stone tools. So, chapter six of the book was all about their stone tool technology and sort of really that's a difficult thing for most people to kind of engage with because it's hard to just read about that and understand it, you know. Actually, that's quite a visual thing, really. So that one was tricky to do, especially because I, you know, as it being my specific area, I was like tempted to like, you know, go far too much into detail. Probably people think it's too detailed already, that chapter bit. But I really tried to, you know, simplify things right down to concepts that are not going to be confusing to use no jargon.
I think one of the ones of my favorite ones that I really enjoyed was about the skeleton of the baby,
Oh, yeah.
and the mother, kind of imagining the mother giving birth to this child and then nursing it and then it dying and then having to eventually abandon the child but wanting to bury it and kind of protect it from any harm still, and it being like lying under the surface for thousands of years and
Yeah.
then being found. I think placed a really good connection between where we are now and kind of tying that, showing that line, that connection, because it's such a long time ago. It's really difficult to get a grip on what that means for something to have
Yeah.
been, 200,000 years ago, 400,000 years ago. But that immediately brought for me like a connection between then and now, which was really powerful.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing about sort of being an archaeologist and Neanderthals. It's true for me as well, for myself and other colleagues as well, that you know, to some extent you have to remove yourself emotionally. And you know, Neanderthal babies are fascinating because of what they can tell us about growth and development and the species and you know,
And it's the subject is incredibly interdisciplinary, as you were describing earlier, and it does require, it's not just like you say about the archaeology or about the geology or the science of it, it's also about those more philosophical questions about what the psychology might have been or how much it felt, or what would motivate someone to bury something in the ground, all of those kind of things. That's only when you combine all of those different disciplines together can you get as full a picture as what you convey in the book.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because you know the question about burial and that's always been something that people have debated for a long time, and people bring to that debate their own, you know, assumptions and beliefs about what is meaningful in, you know, in human interactions with bodies. You know, what we do with the dead and what is a permitted level of meaningful treatment of a body and things like that, but we're often coming from a particular modern Western understanding of what you do with a body, what you should do with it, what you shouldn't do with it, and you know, therefore expectations that if we're not going to find Neanderthals laid out straight in sort of a square pit, then it doesn't mean anything what they did. I don't accept that at all, and
No.
you only have to look back at, you know, the past 1,000 years of Christian tradition to see how much it's changed in terms of what people believed was a respectful, meaningful way of dealing with the dead. It's totally transformed today, even.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the usual format of this podcast is obviously that our guests choose one year in history, but that's not really quite so easy with this subject. So if you could travel back in time, perhaps it's better to ask you what period would you travel back in time to?
Yeah, so although we have fantastic dating methods, we have a whole range of dating methods, they don't give you 1 year in Neanderthal archaeology, doesn't happen. So I will choose a particular roughly 10,000 year period in the middle kind of part of Neanderthal's existence, so starting around 126,000 years ago. So, I mean, obviously, from the perspective of the other guests that you have on this podcast, that sounds a bit bonkers and 10 millennia, you know.
They're probably jealous. It's indulgent.
But I mean, that's about 500 generations. But if you're looking at the overall span of the time that Neanderthals were in existence, that's only about 3% of their whole sort of chronological realm. So the reason I chose this period, it's known as the Eemian. In Britain, we call it the Ipswichian. They're basically climate terms based on sites where you had particular pollen sequences and things which identify this as a particular climate period. And why I've chosen it is it's the opposite of what most people will be picturing Neanderthals as, you know, the world that they lived in. This is a warm climate period. It's what we call an interglacial rather than a glacial or a cold ice age. You know, a lot of people will be thinking like the ice age, but there was more than one ice age. There were many cycles going from cold. The last ice age we had ended about 11 to 10,000 years ago. Then it was slightly warmer and then it was colder, you know, and it goes right back. So there's multiple phases. This was the warmest interglacial that the Neanderthals lived in. It's actually the warmest interglacial that any hominid species encountered and survived. So it's nearly tropical rather than tundra. And the reason it was warmer was because basically subtle differences in where the Earth's orbital position was meant that more sunlight fell on the Earth during the summer, which was enough to really dramatically shift average temperatures up somewhere between 2 to 4 degrees warmer than today, which doesn't sound like much, but actually it's a lot. It's enough that we can see, for example, in alpine caves up in the mountains now, the snow line had moved well up and the stalagmite growth in those caves starts to begin because it suddenly got warm and moist. And also the melting glaciers and ice sheets all meant that the oceans were rising quite rapidly at the beginning and certainly reach somewhere between 5 to 8 meters above where the shoreline is today, which is dramatic. You know, that's a vast amount of difference. Unlike when the sea levels go down a lot because it gets super cold, the coastline itself doesn't change that much in terms of huge amounts of land being flooded, but in particular regions it was quite dramatic. The big change in terms of the landscape and the world that they were living in was not only was it warm, but as the last ice age before that ended, the vegetation was really, really shifting as well. And so instead of primarily open landscapes with tundra and sort of grassy steppe, what you see straight away at the beginning of the Eemian is a huge growth in trees, and forests essentially begin to spread all over Eurasia. And it's a warm woodland world, and it's so different to people's general understanding of Neanderthals as like hyper-Arctic adapted creatures. That's why I wanted to choose this, really, to kind of explore this other aspect of their life.
So in this period, where would you like to go for your first scene?
I want to go to Britain around 123,000 years ago, so a little bit into the Eemian, and sort of explore what's going on. So when the Eemian started about 126,000 years ago, it was quite dry and hot straight away. It was really quite a rapid change. And it must have been a real sort of shock to the environment, not only to Neanderthals, but to all the animals and things as well. However, it took a few millennia for the forests to really start to grow. So by about 123,000 years ago, you start to see real large-scale woodland, but it was not a single sort of static entity. So in the earlier phases, if we sort of try and fly through time, you have we know from the pollen data is what really tells us this. It's like if you put a core down through ancient lake bed deposits, you can see how the pollen changes through time going up through that core, and that shows you what the landscape was like. So we can literally see this woodland sort of mutating from cooler species after that previous ice age, so like birch and juniper and pine. The pine forest starts to get established, but then quite quickly it begins to look like an oak forest, you know, something that you would see pretty much in Britain today, but with elm as well, hazel, yew, linden, ivy, boxwood, and then eventually Through those few thousand years, it matures into a hornbeam forest, hornbeam and beech. But if you go to 123,000 years ago, that's when it was at its warmest, really, and the forest is very dense. And if you'd been walking around the forests in Britain at that time, you would have heard, rather than these pine forest birds, for your dawn chorus, like crossbills or crested tits. And by the time you get to 123,000 years ago, you'd be listening to something that is pretty much what our woodlands now should sound like. For example, we've got jays, and roller birds as well, beautiful roller birds. So the kind of the richness of the dawn chorus would have been immense. And then as it gets cooler as well, you then sort of see the changes to like capercaillie, black grouse, and those kind of species. So the point in time when it's warmest, it actually would be quite recognisable to people today.
And would there be Neanderthal communities living in Britain at that time, yet they would have been in living in the forests, or?
Well, that's the strange thing. We know from the continent that Neanderthals were living in this, full-on forest environment. They were walking around through the trees, they were living underneath dappled light, and it was hot, and they would have been pretty much, tree people. They would have grown up surrounded by gigantic trees, maybe bigger even than we see in forests today. The lost medieval forests, for example. Those trees were all cut down for naval timber and things, and it does make you wonder, what those trees look like. And I wonder what these trees look like that were just, undisturbed at all for thousands of years, these ancient deciduous forests. But although we know Neanderthals were definitely on the continent, it doesn't look like there was anybody in Britain at all. People, researchers have looked at this question for a long time because it seemed a bit strange. But as far as we can tell, in this warm period in the Eemian, there was nobody here but the animals. So that's quite a strange idea. So if you were a traveller through time, you would be walking around, you'd be hearing, all the bird song, you'd see the light, the streams, all the insects buzzing around, you'd see animal trails everywhere. But no people, no traces of people at all, across the whole of the British Isles. We don't think there was anyone here. And the reason for that, is probably two things. One is that at the end of the Ice Age before that, the ice sheets had come down quite low towards Northern Europe. And in front of ice sheets, when they start to melt, you get what's called a proglacial lake, which just basically means it's a lake, a huge lake, in front of the ice sheets. As all that meltwater starts to accumulate. And we know that there was one of these massive lakes, basically running across where the North Sea is now. But at that time, there was a chalk ridge that used to run between the continent and Britain. And that lake burst through that in like a catastrophic flood. It was absolutely immense. And it was so sort of, monstrously violent that the scouring that it left on the bottom of the channel, it looks more like what you see on Mars today. These just gigantic valleys, battered out by this cataclysm. So
And
that
they're still
left.
visible, sorry, they're still visible today, those, yeah.
Yes, you only see it with sonar though, because it's under the channel now. They're underneath like an overburden of other sediment, but you can see what happened to the bedrock. So that event probably left that whole landscape, which was dry after the lake had gone, completely trashed, just like a wasteland. No vegetation, just bare ground. So it's not really a very promising area for hunter gatherers to want to cross in the first place. So that may well have been difficult to cross. And then it looks like the climate change at the beginning of the Eemian was so rapid that the sea level may have come back very fast and cut Britain off before Neanderthals actually started moving towards, thinking about going over there. So animals got over, some animals got over, and it may be that the species that made it were ones that could easily cross either boggy ground or relatively open water or rivers. It's a very strange sort of concept. We know that Neanderthals were, little smoke trails coming up from the forest on the continent and across the channel, which was a little bit larger. We know, for example, that from old excavations underneath London, for example, people often sort of quote, oh, there were lions and hippos under Trafalgar Square and stuff. We know that these animals were all there but not people.
Well, do we know when the first humans came to Britain?
Well, Neanderthals had been there long before that. They had already been here, and then that previous ice age was so cold that it seems that they abandoned Britain, but they were there for a long time before that. The oldest Neanderthal site in Britain that's like a fully Neanderthal, you would expect them, is about 270,000 years ago, and that's in Wales, Pontnewydd, it's called. And then we have earlier sort of pre-Neanderthal sites as well, 400,000 years and way back as well. So like hominins were in Britain many times, but through these climatic pulses, when it got super cold, Britain was usually abandoned. But when it was warmer, they would come back. But the Eemian is different, and it may be because, as I say, that the sea level rose so fast or was just higher than normal. I don't know, that that they just didn't get a chance to come over. But horses didn't come either, which is very interesting. So they Neanderthals and horses only returned to Britain somewhere around 65,000 years ago, so much later, as things got cooler again and the sea level drops, and there is this huge area of land in between us and the continent, then horses and Neanderthals come back as soon as it's possible. They do. So something was clearly preventing it.
You use the word homonym. That's right, is it homonym?
Yeah.
And I just was wondering if we could go over what that word means, and also before we meet the Neanderthals themselves, to kind of clarify exactly. I know there's a misconception that they're somehow a previous version of human before we get to our version of human, but that's not right.
No, so hominin basically just means our close relatives that were, you know, pretty much on the same lineage as us. So we are primates and we are apes, and so are chimpanzees, but chimpanzees are not hominins. They did their own thing. They had their own lineage that separated off from anything that was ever going to turn into us, like 7 million years ago. So they've been doing their own thing. They're just as evolved as us, but they've just went on their own path. So we're Neanderthals, and we come from, you're looking at Africa, and our origins in the Homo genus. So we're both in the Homo genus. So we're Homo sapiens, Neanderthals are Homo neanderthalensis. The Homo genus, we believe, evolves in Africa somewhere between 2 and 1 million years ago. What happens after about a million years ago until about 500,000 years ago is a bit tricky, because they're not actually masses and masses of fossils, or they haven't been till that recently. What we do know from the last few decades of work is that there was no sort of single neat little highway leading towards us. It's much more like, not even like a tree or a bush. The analogy that we like to use now is like a braided river, where you've got sort of rivulets coming and going, some of them meeting again, some of them going off and sort of dissolving and not really doing anything. But the impression is that populations in Africa were in different regions and they had different anatomy, but then almost like a mosaic forming, some of those groups were interacting with each other and features were sort of being shared. And eventually for Homo sapiens, hominins that look like us, so we would call them early Homo sapiens, probably very early, that's about 300,000 years ago in Africa. Whereas by that point, Neanderthals were already themselves evolving in Europe and Western Eurasia. So what we don't know really is where the lineage where we both come from, where that was actually based, probably in Africa. And we do know genetically that that is somewhere around 800,000 to 600,000 years ago. The Homo lineage split, and what would become us went in one direction. What would become Neanderthals and the Denisovans, which is another Eurasian hominin population contemporary with Neanderthals, they split, and then they split again, and the Neanderthals went off, and you know, that was their lineage. So they're like Western Eurasians, and it appears, although we don't know that much, that Denisovans were more like Central and Eastern Eurasian hominins, but living at the same time. And we definitely know from the genetics that we were all on occasion meeting and interacting and making babies. So there's that as well.
is that quite a new bit of a new revelation that's come out in the last few years? Because I was listening to a podcast from, I think it was about 10 years ago, where somebody was saying that there was no evidence to suggest that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens did interbreed, but that's not true anymore.
That's literally the last 10 years basically. Yeah. So until that point, there was a lot of debate about whether we had ever had any direct ancestry from the Neanderthals themselves. And, you know, there were some view of things which said that we, you know, we basically dispersed from Africa and then encountered the Neanderthals but replaced them, or they were already going extinct and then we sort of came in afterwards, but that there was no actual interbreeding. But then there was another perspective that said that there were probably very ancient hominin populations across the old world, and that there was some kind of gene flow over very long time periods between those different populations, which led to sort of Homo sapiens emerging in different regions at different times. So that's not, that doesn't seem to be correct either. What does seem to have happened is that it's slightly more like the first theory, really, that we did emerge in Africa, but as soon as we start to disperse from Africa, which is a lot earlier than we used to think, it now looks like we were humans that would have looked very much like present day people, were in the Near East by 180,000 years ago, so super old, and right the way across into China by 80,000 at least, and into Australia by 65,000.
Wow.
So that sort of depth of time for which we were dispersing away from Africa and interacting with these other hominins, Neanderthals, Denisovans, probably even other more archaic species that had left Africa 2 million years ago and have been, you know, hanging out in Eurasia all that time. The span of time during which there is potential for those interactions is so much bigger than we used to think, that it's not surprising that the genetics tells us that that definitely was going on.
And I think in your second scene that you'd like to visit, we meet the Neanderthals and they're hunting deer. Would you like to tell us a bit about about that second scene and about the animals that Neanderthals would have interacted with on the continent?
Yeah, so rather than staying in Britain, where, although the forest is very nice, there's nobody actually there.
Nobody to hang out with.
Yeah. this is the full Eemian when it's nice and warm, but we're on the continent this time. What I really like about the Eemian is how surprising the environment is. You know, the woodlands themselves are familiar, you know, the birds and everything, but the animals... weird. Some of the animals that had lived during the colder periods were there. So aurochs were around, which are the ancestors to some of today's cattle species, and they were huge, like 6 foot at the shoulder, gigantic horns. They you wouldn't think of them as forest species, but they really were. Bison as well, and people often think of bison as like, you know, grassland species because you're thinking of North American prairie bison. But bison in Europe have been forest species for a long time, and they still live in forests in Poland. Neanderthals ate a lot of food. That's one thing we should get straight at the beginning. they basically would take the best of what was around them. So they were big game hunters, but they also would take other stuff. So in the Eemian, Neanderthals definitely hunted beavers when they could get them. The beavers' tails are full of really good fat. They're excellent nutritionally. And beavers obviously are like these amazing environmental sort of architects. They create their own environments, their own niches. In the south of Europe, where it was more arid during some of the arid periods of the Eemian, you get sort of Asian species like porcupine coming in as well, quite unexpected. And then there are some familiar species like roe deer. You know, people today will see roe deer. If you go out into the forests in Britain today, you can see them. Obviously, we have some boar now in Britain. They did used to be native. Neanderthals were also living surrounded by megafauna, true big, big beasts, except they weren't like the woolly kind. they were the warm forest kind. So you have forest rhinoceros, different species.
A rhinoceros in Europe?
Oh, yeah, because we had woolly rhinos during the cold periods and Neanderthals hunted them as well. But these are a different species. They're not the same as the ones in Africa and Asia today. This is an extinct species, but they were like associated with warmer climates. So we call them forest rhinoceros. Water buffalo and a straight tusked elephant species that's massive, sort of bigger than mammoths even.
Wow.
And hippopotamus. So yeah, there was even hippos up in Yorkshire.
A real eclectic mix.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's the native interglacial fauna that we would have if there was no people around and it was perhaps a degree warmer or so. But there's you know, there's been some interesting discussions about, you know, rewilding and what's missing, and people often focus on the, you know, the big predators like lynx or, you know, things like this, but these massive forest creatures are, in theory, they're also the native species. We should have elephants in our forest, but we don't.
And how do we know that all of these animals were living in Europe? Do we have their bones that remain?
Oh yeah. Yeah, they're all over the place. I mean, the basic principle for archaeology is you look at the depth of things, you know, the deeper it is, the older it is. But we also now have, like, just as I said before, a huge array of different dating methods, so we can directly date either the bones or beyond that period, where radiocarbon dating works. You can date the sediments around stuff, or teeth themselves, things like this. So we're quite sure that this is a real thing.
How many meters deep do you have to dig into the ground to get to the Eemian period?
It depends. In some places it might be 12 meters, 40 meters, or it might be much less. It depends on what's happened since, because you have to remember that. In fact, one of the reasons that for a long time people didn't really know if Neanderthals were sort of that happy in a forest environment is because there's not that many Eemian sites preserved. And that's because after the Eemian, there was another really harsh glacial period, not the last one before the time we live now. It's like the one before that would basically remove through erosion a lot of these warm period sediments and deposits. So the few places we find Eemian age deposits, sometimes they're in caves, but not that much, but around lake basins, you know, where you have these natural thick build-ups, and as long as they don't get scraped off by anything or eroded out, then you've got like this really deep, lovely deep archive. And it, the same goes for periods, for warm periods before the Eemian, so the one prior to that. Again, we have similar sort of range of animals, and then the one before that, you know, so we have this deep archive showing how, like, these pulses of animal life completely changed over tens and tens and tens of millennia.
Yeah, and I guess, where would you place Neanderthals in that chain of prey and predator? They obviously, like you said, that they hunted rhinoceros, but were they vulnerable to being attacked by lions and bears?
Yeah, they would have always been vulnerable if they let the guard down, for sure. We do have a few sites here and there across Europe through time where we can see Neanderthal bones, like the odd bit of leg or something that has been gnawed by animals. There's even, I think, a site in Poland where, is it a child's tooth or a fingertip or something that has been through the digestive system of a large raptor, so like a large bird of prey, probably an eagle or something, or a vulture. So yeah, now and then they were the prey, but most of the time they were the top hunters in their environment. And we know this because the ordering of damage on the bones of the animals, so the gnawing and the biting marks from like hyena teeth, they're always underneath the cut marks from Neanderthal stone tools. Not like always, but 90% of the time you can tell that it's Neanderthals who had those carcasses first. The scene that we're in right now in this hornbeam forest, 123,000 years ago, we're in Germany, and this is a deer hunt that was going on. And we know this because we have these fantastic preserved sites, a German site called Neumark Nord. It's an old lake basin. And it makes sense that Neanderthals are going to be attracted to water, just like other animals are. They need that water, especially if it's a warm, hot world. But also it's the place where game is going to be reliably found. It's difficult to hunt animals, even big animals like elephant. You'd be surprised that they can really just disappear into forests. But you know that all animals are going to be coming to find water. And so at this site, Neumark Nord, there's actually remains of hundreds and hundreds of animals that have been excavated from around this huge lake basin. And amongst a lot of deer, fallow deer, there are two stags, really nice, you know, big stags, almost complete skeletons, but they were definitely hunted. And they come with sort of Neanderthal style bullet holes. It's the holes from the spears. We can actually see that.
Wow. They have a different anatomy to us in many ways. They're not exactly the same. And is there particular aspects of how they were made up that made them better hunters than we would be?
It's funny, you know, not many people say, were they better than us? Usually they're like, are they more rubbish than us? but yeah, I mean, their bodies don't seem to have been built for long distance running. We can tell from the thickness of the bone, although part of the thickness of their bone is genetic, it's probably also to do with massive amounts of activity. But we can also see that on the bones where the muscles were attaching, that they were definitely like hugely active, even from childhood. They were probably walking either long distances or just around a lot, or both. But they don't seem to have been especially well adapted to like the kind of long distance running that our bodies are more obviously built for. But they were probably still quite fast, just over short bursts. So they may have been very good at sort of ambush hunting, where you've got to wait and then suddenly explode, you know, and really go for it. And they definitely, as far as we can tell, were probably stronger than us. So they may have had a much more sort of devastating spear thrust than we might have done. Their hands, their actual grip around the shaft of a spear, seems like they were just as dexterous, you know, most of the time, but they were very strong. So that's an interesting combination for, you know, control of your weapons at the same time as having sort of real brute force that would be necessary if you're trying to take down animals without using ranged weapons like thrown spears. It's really quite something.
Hello, I'm Peter. What we try and do in this podcast is not just to analyse the history of the year we're exploring, but also to evoke it in a visual way. Someone who aims to do the exact same thing is Jordan Lloyd. Jordan is a superb visual historian and one of the world's leading photo colourists. You might know a little bit about colourisation already. The process involves finding old black and white imagery and transforming the image so the vivid reality of the actual moment is recovered. If you've looked on our website recently, you'll have seen some brilliant examples of Jordan's work. Striking portraits of Abraham Lincoln and Mark Twain, the streets of Chinatown in San Francisco in 1896. All of these are transformed by revolutionary new digital processes. Travels Through Time is very proud to be partnering with Jordan. You can buy prints of his work at colorgraph.co. That's color spelt the American way, C-O-L-O-R, colorgraph.co. And if you enter the code TTT at the checkout, you'll get 10% off everything. They make wonderful presents, so do check out colorgraph.co.
I mean, those differences in technology, I guess, are really vital. And maybe that's a good place to move on to your final scene that you'd like to talk to us about, because that's focused very much about tools and about and materials that Neanderthals were using.
Yeah, we're sort of, we can be back in this Eemian world. We've gone back again into this warm world full of oak trees. We're actually back at the Neumark lakeshore again, but in another season, very likely not exactly the same century, probably not the same millennium even, but across the Lake Basin. And I wanted us to come to this scene because it's another way to sort of open our minds up to how the forest world changed what Neanderthals did and offered them new opportunities, because obviously it was challenging, but also there were new opportunities there. So they hunted differently, like we've just been talking about, but also the forest itself is a hugely rich resource in terms of the plants and the vegetation. So we know from loads of sites through different periods with Neanderthals that they definitely were using plant foods, but what they would eat would vary depending on when and, you know, geographically where they live. So in the Near East, you get things like olives and, you know, stuff like that. In Northern Europe during the Eemian, it's the kind of things that you would find in forests today. So nuts, hazelnuts, berries like sloes, maybe things like this. There are sites where we see sort of charred remains of these things, which may be indicating that those were actually eaten. But it's not that easy to sort of just collect plant food. You know, if you've ever done any bushcraft in a British forest, it's quite tricky because a lot of the things that you think you might eat, like acorns, they need a lot of processing to take away the toxins and stuff. So it takes time and effort to actually eat and survive in a deciduous forest. But it does seem that Neanderthals were using plants more in previous periods. We don't see on their teeth, we don't see patterns of polish and wear that really look like they were either processing with their mouths plant materials or eating a lot of plant stuff. But when the Eemian, for samples from the Eemian, it looks a bit more like they're actually doing that. And in some cases, it almost looks like prehistoric agricultural communities, you know, that they're doing something with their teeth that involves a lot of, you know, abrasive materials, which is probably plants. So we can't see exactly what that is from the teeth, but we do get hints. And it's probably going to be quite diverse because, as I say, in other settings, we know that they were eating grass seeds, probably charring them. And there's also really cool evidence that they were eating water lily roots. So if there was this lush vegetated environment during the Eemian, we can be sure that they were curious and they would have been exploring what was available. But one thing that's really nice from this place, this site at Neumark Nord, is like a tiny little window into the level of interaction with plants that was going on. So first of all, we know that they were making spears with wood. From these sites, in the Eemian, they were using yew wood. In other periods, they were selecting woods for their wooden artefacts that always make sense from where they are. You know, they're choosing the best of what's there. But really absolutely amazing object from Neumark. Looks like almost, you know, nothing. It doesn't look very interesting when you first see it, but what it is really like jaw-dropping. So it's a flake, it's a flint flake with this tiny little brown scrap stuck on it. And it's organic. And when it was analysed, it was found to be full of oak tannins. Incredibly concentrated. This is not some kind of sort of natural blob of stuff that's stuck on it. What it seems to be is that this is a remnant of probably some kind of binding that was around this flake. So it may have been part of a composite tool, you know, made of more than one part and bound together, which we know they were doing from other places. And it's been preserved because of being soaked in oak tannins. And so that's exactly the reason that we find bog bodies, you know, these Celtic and Iron Age bog bodies that we find across Europe. Those have this incredible preservation because of the tannins from the peats. These are natural plant extracts that come out into the water. And something similar has preserved this little scrap on the tool. And to get oak tannins, you have to macerate, you have to really process bark. So what we're probably looking at is that this is Neanderthals doing some kind of tanning, using oak bark, probably for working animal hides.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we have abundant evidence from many different settings that they definitely were processing animal skins, fresh animal skins, and in some cases dried ones. So that suggests that they were making leather. But to actually use tannins and sort of go this extra stage of using, you know, tanning the leather to preserve it, to give it colour, to help keep it waterproof. This is all shown by this one tiny little thing on a flake, you know, and if nobody had bothered to analyse that, we wouldn't know it.
Yeah.
And it's by itself, it sort of just like seems anomalous. But just this year, there was published at a French site, a tiny little twist of fibers that were preserved underneath just a natural mineral film on a stone flake from this rock shelter. And we know that this mineral sort of preservation process, it's all over lots of different artifacts. This particular one has got this little twist of fibers, and when they were looked at super magnification, it really looks like it is a 3-ply thread. So wow. That's where you have three little threads that are all twisted in one direction, and then you twist the three of them together in the other direction. So it's an S twist versus a Z twist, which is exactly what you have, you know, in how we make modern, you know, like if you have a linen scarf or something, you're going to have this kind of production. And when they analyzed that chemically, It comes out as matching conifer bark, maybe conifer root. So although it's really small, it's not even a cord, you know, it's more like a thread. It really does suggest that Neanderthals were doing quite complex things with plants. Now, this French site is not as old as the Emin, it's later, but it's another tiny window into what we know is missing. Among hunter-gatherers, most of their stuff is perishable, you know, it's made from plants or bits of animal, and that's the stuff that just very rarely survives in the record. And so although when we get these little one-offs like this twist of bark or this little blob of tanned stuff at Neumark in the Emian, you know, they are one-offs, but they still are revealing something to us about the complexity of Neanderthals' understanding of the materials all around them and what those forests could actually offer them. So yeah, that's my little sort of final scene.
And the fact that such a, even though it's such a tiny amount that survived, we can assume that even that, if that has survived over such a long period of time, that when it was originally made, it would be part of something quite long thread or that kind
of
thing.
I mean the thread, who knows what that was for? It's so small. It's not like rope, it's not like string even, you know, it is very small. So I mean, not everybody is you know, totally happy with that because it seems so outlandish, but for me, because we have this other thing from Neumark, even though it's much older, it still is really pointing at complex understanding of how you process plant materials, basically. And we can see it in how they make their wood artifacts as well, like the spears. They're not just pointed sticks, so they know how to use the stump end for the tip of the spear, because that's the hardest part of the wood. And more than that, they actually offset where they're carving the spear, they take it offset through the grain of the wood, because that makes it more robust. So if we can see that level of craftsmanship in woodworking, why would we not expect something similar with other kinds of plant materials? It's just we just don't see it. If they were tanning hides to do that, that takes quite a long time, you know, it can take weeks. So that might be telling us something about how their wider lives were organised in the Emian. Maybe they were not moving around as much in a forest world as they would have been in an open world. If people were moving around less, perhaps the groups were a little bit smaller. We don't know, but it all ties together that the hunting is different, the animals are different, the kind of plants are different, maybe the seasonality is different as well. So it's everything sort of comes together to show you a completely unexpected, totally different world that the Neanderthals were actually still completely at home in, you know, and we don't expect that.
Certainly a much more complex picture than the stereotypical caveman that people might think of.
Definitely.
Yeah.
With composite tool technology, where you have a piece of stone and you make an adhesive, maybe just as a handle or to stick another wooden handle onto it, that's also very skilled. We can see that there is different ways that they did that. Some Neanderthals used bitumen, so like natural asphalt that you can just find sometimes in geological deposits, but not everywhere. That's in the Near East, and there's a Romanian site too. But there's also a hint that might have been going on in from a Spanish site, where we can see in the tartar on a Neanderthal's tooth, there's a hint of bitumen in there. So that might have been going on in Spain. But other adhesives we know they were making was birch tar, which you have to actually cook that out of the bark and, you know, pay attention to the fire. You can't just stick it in a fire, it'll burn. You have to kind of make sure that it's sort of got a low oxygen atmosphere and things like this, so it's kind of like damped down, and you have to watch it for a long time. So that's quite complex. And then we also seem to have in Italy, there's a recent find suggesting that they were using plant resins mixed with beeswax. So those are all quite complex production systems. And the question is, did all Neanderthals know how to do those things? Or, you know, maybe they did all know, maybe they did all observe and sort of learn through an informal process. But perhaps some of them were just better at it, and so they did it more. So, you know, that's a possibility. I don't see why we wouldn't be looking at some level of you know, individual craftsmanship and individuals being better at something and doing it a bit more often and things like this.
It sounds absolutely fascinating. I love the idea of being able to take such a tiny, tiny remain, like a kind of grain of sand from the massive human historical evidence, and being able to find out so much about a people just from something so tiny. I think it's quite exciting.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I'm going to ask you now a final question before we have to come back to the present from the Eamon period. I'm kind of jealous because it sounds quite warm and lush and it's getting a bit cold in London at the moment. But if you could bring back one Neanderthal memento with you into the present, what would you like to bring?
Well, if I'm restricting myself to the Eemian only, so sort of this 10,000 year period, roughly beginning around 126,000 years ago, then I think I would probably try and bring back one of the spears that killed those deer at Neumark Nord, because we don't have hardly any spears from the Neanderthal world. The ones we have are all amazing, and they each have given us, you know, massive insights into their technology, and that spins out into insights about the society. So I would like one of those spears. I'd like to know what it was made of, how it was made, whether it was repaired, what other animals it killed. You know, I'd just like to know everything. So I want one of them spears.
So you wouldn't use it yourself, it would be for research purposes only?
I might caress it a bit and then do some research on it.
Nice. I love that. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Rebecca. It's so exciting to try something new and to go so far back into the past. It's really different, and I've really enjoyed speaking to you.
Well, thank you so much, and I really hope the listeners enjoy it, and I hope they like having their minds blown chronologically.
I'm sure they will. That was me, Artemis Irvin, talking to Dr. Rebecca Ragsykes about the Neanderthals who lived 126,000 years ago. I hope our conversation persuaded you that you should go and read her brilliant book, Kindred. It's published by Bloomsbury and is available to buy now. But if you are of the podcast persuasion, as I suspect many of you are, you can also listen to Kindred as an audiobook on Audible, and it's being read by Rebecca herself. Check out our website for more information and resources about this episode and many others at tttpodcast.com. But until next week, thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.